From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 59 of Little Brother, dated the 6th of November, 2021. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. So let's get started! Last week, while talking about the NRA hack, I mentioned in passing that the U.S. State Department had put a bounty of $5 million a couple of years ago for information that would lead to the capture or conviction of the leaders of Evil Corp, the Russian hacking group responsible for the Grief, Drydex, BitPamer, and DoppelPamer malwares. On Thursday, they issued a new bounty, $10 million, for the capture or conviction of the leadership of DarkSide, and $5 million for any individual conspiring with them. From the reading of the press release, it's clear that this is the department's response to the ransomware attack last May that led to the shutdown of the Colonial Pipeline. The shutdown led to several days of shortages and panic buying, which in turn led to unsafe handling of fuel and numerous accidents between the 8th and 13th of May of this year. Colonial Pipeline themselves ended up paying a ransom of around $5 million in order to get their systems back in service. We've all heard the legal term subpoena. It's Latin for under penalty. A typical subpoena begins with the words something like, "You are hereby commanded to appear at the time, the date, and the place shown below to testify before the court." A specific kind of subpoena called a ducis tecum, Latin for bring with you, is used to demand records, documents, and other evidence that you might hold that is relevant to a court case. Most of the time, these are not documents that are fun to be on the receiving end. Despite this, Signal Messenger seems to enjoy writing on their blog about the subpoenas that they receive. The reason is simple. Most of the time, subpoenas ask for information that Signal just very simply does not have. One such recent subpoena identified a user by their name, date of birth, telephone number, and commanded Signal to produce all records that they possess with subscriber information, financial information, transaction history, job-related information, online behaviors, logs of their activities, content to their communications, responses to surveys, connected applications, referrals. In all, the demand goes on for 10 pages describing what the court wants and how to go about providing it. In contrast, Signal's response was a single page, not even a full page at that, not counting the two-page cover letter. The single page gave the time of the last connection to their servers by the specified user and the time that the account was created. The cover letter explained, as so many before it had, that any further information is information that, thanks to end-to-end encryption, Signal just does not have at all. Networking technology from Chinese manufacturers, including ZTE and Huawei, are soon to be purged out of American cellular networks. The FCC has kicked off a program that reimburses small carriers for the cost of replacing their equipment, which has been blacklisted by the government as a threat to national security. Once replaced, the decommissioned equipment is said to be destroyed to prevent salvage and recommissioning, and the potential risk that might represent. Carriers availing themselves of the program are expected to complete their upgrades within a year of accepting the first payment. Speaking of blacklisted vendors, in episodes 44 and 52, I spoke about the NSO Group, purveyors of the Pegasus spyware. This week, the U.S. Commerce Department added the Israeli company to their blacklist, along with Kandaroo, Positive Technologies and COSA Inc. of Israel, Russia, and Singapore, respectively. The blacklisting prevents companies operating in the United States from buying from or selling to these overseas counterparts. All of these organizations allegedly deal in offensive cyberware and hacking tools. GitLab, a popular revision control system, has a vulnerability in which it does not properly validate image files that are sent to it. This enables a remote code execution, which is always a big deal in theory. However, in this case, it has become in practice. Damian Mencher, a security engineer for Google, tweeted a few days ago that thousands of GitLab installations have been taken over by attackers to create a giant botnet, which is being used to carry out a distributed denial-of-service attack in excess of a terabit per second. His advice, as mine, as always, is this: patch your systems. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. And you know what that music means? It's time for another episode of Who Got Pwned This Week. In a late-breaking story, this week we have the Dallas Police Department. Again. Well, sort of again. Last time I spoke about Dallas, it was an own goal in that they had lost 22 terabytes of data in a storage migration and then relocated some of it a few weeks later. I spoke about that in episodes 48 and 54. Also included in this leak somehow is the Atlanta Police Department. This time, about 1.9 terabytes of aerial surveillance video was exfiltrated, over 600 hours of it in all. Distributed Denial of Secrets says, quote, "The extensive footage reveals the capabilities of the military-grade technology behind police surveillance. It also highlights the voyeurism inherent in the surveillance and how it often focuses on protected First Amendment activities and people who have no idea that they're being watched and who have done nothing to justify the intrusion of surveillance," end quote. Obviously, since I mentioned distributed denial of secrets, the data are available in the usual places by the usual means. Before I begin this story, just a quick note to pedants. I realize that the different programming languages may be compiled or interpreted or both. In this article, I'm going to use the terms interpreter and compiler interchangeably to refer to whatever mechanism is in place that processes the source code, as this problem affects both. Software publishers go to some trouble to make sure that the software that you download and install on your systems are the software that they intended you to have. Some publishers do a better job than others, and some ecosystems do better than others, but care is generally taken with part of the installation of software being a check of the download files to confirm that they're at least looking like what they're supposed to. But what happens when the code itself is corrupt? It's standard fare for software publishers to test their code before they send it out, usually using a suite of tests that they've built up over time, including tests that look for bugs that they've already fixed that might reemerge, tests to confirm that new features work as expected, and so on. It's also standard fare for software publishers to hold code reviews. These are sessions where the code that you have written is scrutinized by your coworkers and management to check it for style, errors, suggest improvements, and so on. When deployed in good faith, these are also a great learning opportunity. You may find yourself, for instance, reviewing a tranche of code that a coworker has written and finding that they have a better way of doing something than you had thought of. You may find yourself with your code being reviewed and a coworker offering some ideas on how to compact, clarify, or correct the function of your code. But what happens if the code looks different to you than it does to the compiler?
Unicode has entered the chat.
When computers began to be widespread in the 1980s. A set of mappings was made, setting every character of the English alphabet, both upper and lowercase, and many symbols, numbers, basically anything you find on your average American keyboard, associating each one with a sequence of 7 bits. This encoding is called the American Standard Code for Information Interchange, or ASCII. Between then and now, a lot of work has been put into the task of making computers friendly to users of languages other than English. Languages with accent marks, such as French, Polish, Spanish, etc. Languages with entirely different alphabets, such as Russian or Greek. And even languages that read from right to left rather than left to right, such as Arabic and Hebrew. All of this has been added on by extending the number of bits to represent a given character, in some cases even having characters represented by different numbers of bits. The new extended coding system is called Unicode, and the most commonly used variant in Western nations is called UTF-8. Hell, I'm even typing the script to this show in UTF-8. Anyway, this is grossly oversimplified, but the main idea is that you can now put characters from different alphabets and traveling in different directions into text, which ultimately is what source code is, text. It has been a meme amongst programmers for some years now to suggest pranking your coworkers by replacing a semicolon in source code with a Greek question mark. Semicolons are used a lot in many programming languages and are critical to the code being properly processed by the compiler in those languages, so putting in a character that looks exactly like it, but isn't, is the sort of thing that'll drive a programmer nuts trying to figure it out. But that's just a prank. What happens when it turns malevolent? Security researchers Nicholas Boucher of the University of Cambridge and Ross Anderson of the Universities of Cambridge and Edinburgh recently published an academic paper in which they describe using the direction-changing capability of Unicode to make source code on a screen appear to do one thing while doing another thing. The core technique is to put a reversal into a comment or a text string or some other place where such a thing would not inherently be out of place, but leaving it in such a way that the text flips direction unexpectedly. This would enable an attacker to put text in that looks like a comment, but isn't, just by reversing the order of the characters on a line of code. There is a possibility that this would not be spotted on a code review. Now, there are some things that can be done to mitigate this problem. One of the things is to pay close attention to syntax highlighting. When opened for viewing, the source code will be color-coded by the editor to show what portions of the code are what syntactic components. Code that should be a comment and isn't would stand out for being in the wrong color. Now, you can also scan the code programmatically, looking for characters that are out of the ordinary. This shouldn't be an actual error because there are times when this is appropriate, but it could be a warning, just a little flag that says, hey, someone played a reverse card here. Of course, all of this prompts the question of how malevolent code makes its way into the source. I will leave the details to your imagination. However, I will mention that it seems a rather large number of companies and organizations have been getting pwned lately. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to all of those who have helped me put stories together into this episode. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Pwned music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. And our theme music is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well. Are soon to be purged out of U.S. I did it again, damn it.